You're tuned into the all-new Freedom 106.5.
We would like to bring on right now another opinion on the response, well, from one of the persons here to respond to the mid-year budget review, Mr. Vivek Charan. Good morning to you and welcome. He is the chairman of the Confederation of Regional Business Chambers. So good morning to you. Is it exactly what you were expecting, or did you expect more in terms of the presentation?
Well, to be quite honest with you, at the Confederation, working together with other bodies that have been sort of working to represent what business is going through right now with the government, which would be the private sector organization of Trinidad and Tobago as well, PSOT. We have been working, we have been talking to the Ministry of Trade, and what, from our perspective, we see the economy as rebuilding, right? And over the last 10 years, SMEs, the people that Confederation really represents, which would be all those regional chambers that are member chambers across Trinidad, we were hit pretty hard. We felt we didn't have the support that we needed after COVID, during COVID, when we were shut down for 2 years. Then we had to pay all this moratorium. And then after that, we really did not have support. And we felt that a lot of the resources and the support went to much, larger sectors and larger business. So when we look at where we are after the, after the government change and so on, what we were happy with when I listened particularly to each of the submissions made by the various ministers. Two in particular stood out, which was the Minister of Finance talking about some gains made in the deficit, some gains made in all financial circumstances. And in particular, I listened to the Minister of Energy, because, energy is what is going to make the fastest change in our economy. And there seems to be a lot of work happening behind the scenes. And it seems so far that it's positive in the light of what is going to happen. Now, the caveat to that, or the issue with that, is it's not going to happen immediately. Mm-hmm. Some things are happening immediately. We're seeing, according to him, that the data is showing that, we're producing more barrels of oil and so on. But how far is this going to trickle down, and how far is, the expected growth or development going to be when it hits that crucial level, which seems to be around late 2027 or 2028.
Mm-hmm.
Our issue as SMEs is we need to survive until then.
Now, sorry to interrupt, but there is something else that was pointed out by one of our callers as well, in that the time period that you're talking about oil and gas prices and what you just mentioned, because of the conflict happening in the Strait of Hormuz and Iran, USA, Israel, the price of oil and gas went up. So there is a surplus. Was there any discussion on behalf of the businessmen in terms of the economy as to how that surplus would be utilized?
No, not at this point. I mean, the reality is, when the government came in, I think that they were quite clear in saying that some of the difficulties that they themselves faced, which was even funding ministries and so on, that when they first came in, if we look at that first budget speech, or when we look at when the speeches that came out very shortly after the new parliament was inaugurated and so on, they were talking about difficulties that they had to fund the ministries, and that the four ministries were even being funded on a month-to-month basis. I'm sure that the government themselves have, their own costs to deal with. The thing about the surplus is, the surplus isn't going to directly affect or benefit the SMEs, because the issue with the SMEs is really that of the slow commercial activity happening in the country. One.
Mm-hmm.
Two, people's spending habits have tended over the years, particularly after COVID, it appears, to be spending more on food. I think food is in particular taking a large part out of their budgets. After that is medication. When you think about the fact that the average Trinidadian may not be a healthy person. The average Trinidadian over a certain age, and given the, what the government has put out with regard to the CDAP bill, the average Trinidadian may have high blood pressure, diabetes, heart issues, a combination of those things. And when you look at the amount of medication, sometimes people buy on a monthly basis, and the cost of that medication, those are people who are not even on CDAP, it is quite large,
mm-hmm.
right? So between food, that, and just, you know, phone cards, basic living, fixed expenses, internet, cable, all those sort of things, people's disposable income isn't where I think it could be at the moment. But other than that, we also have a problem with the continued shortage of U.S. dollars has impacted the SME sector particularly hard, where the SME sector is mostly it's mostly retail organizations that have been importing goods and selling.
Turnover sellers.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. Well, yeah, retail turnover sellers. And the thing is, when you're looking at a country such as ours, which doesn't have a very deep and wide manufacturing base, right? So, for example, you look at larger countries, look at Mexico. Mm-hmm. Well, larger manufacturing countries. Look at Mexico, India, China. What you would find is, and not even in America, but let's look at those big countries first, right? They are able to feed and clothe themselves primarily first. And being able to feed and clothe yourselves means that their people have access to clothing and food at the lowest price possible without having to import, without having to use Forex or anything. And that is not a position that we are in. Our food import bill, which is, I would say, you know, one of the huge, which is something that we certainly have to deal with and the government has to deal with going forward. But that has to be something that the government and the private sector works on, particularly the agricultural sector,
mm-hmm.
to bring down that food import bill if we are really going to see gains in the way we want to see gains.
Do you think that in terms of the food import bill, because it was another point that one of our callers discussed, do you think that a hardline approach in, if you recall back in the NER administration, there was a negative list. Do you think that that would assist in reducing the import bill and what it looks like if it is that we return to something like that?
Many people have been calling for our, many citizens, I think, kind of support the idea of a negative list. The idea about the negative list is, if it were to be implemented, then it would actually be wider than people would initially imagine.
Because we've become so accustomed. Yeah.
But not only that, to make a dent. I mean, when you look at, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, TT dollars in a sense, being used to import food into the country. When you walk into the aisles in a supermarket and you look at an entire aisles, you know, confectionery in an entire aisle, other products in an entire aisle and so on. To really make a dent in the food import bill, you can do two things. You can say, listen, we're going to stop the importation of a vast number of things, which will have some international consequences, because it would mean that those food distributors, particularly big ones, because all the distribution companies are very large companies attached to conglomerates on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have existing contracts with suppliers abroad. They would then have to break those contracts, or they may have to say, listen, we are no longer going to be trading with you all. A lot of our food comes from brands from the United States. When you look at all those big brands, particularly with things like condiments, processed food, confectionaries, and so on, a lot of it comes from the United States. So it would impact what our trade relations would be in the United States. The best, no, I can't see anywhere around it, to be honest with you. I feel that at some stage, that is something that should be looked at. I think, in a sense, a lot of that has been happening quietly, where there have been conversations with the distributors as, you know, how they can reduce the importation of certain items or concentrate on larger items. I don't know if when we go to the supermarket anymore, we're seeing more and more foreign items coming in. I'm not sure. I think that we are at the peak amount of foreign items we see. I think the real issue with consumers would be that price, right? That price of that food products are at, and how much they feel takes a bite out of their
monthly budget.
Their budgets. Mm-hmm. Right, correct. And the thing is, you know, talking to some people who have supermarkets and so on, people's buying patterns have changed considerably. People don't buy monthly anymore. They sometimes buy every 2 weeks now. So what they try to do is they think that, it comes down to cash flow, right? How is the cash flow? At the end of the month, they tend to have more bills coming in, monthly bills, as it were. So money has to go there. So the idea of waiting until the end of the month to pay, to buy all your groceries in addition to all your
bills, etc.
Right, correct. It's too much, right? Because then you have the week after month end when you get your paycheck, and then it's 3 weeks after that, you have to survive. So the idea is, let's buy some groceries mid-month so that when I do spend on groceries again at month end, there'll be some left over. But you see, the key thing here is that while I heard a lot about, you know, I heard about the energy sector, I heard about some gains that we're making when it comes to the metrics, the economic metrics, you know, with regard to things like you know, deficits and so on.
Mm-hmm.
The key thing is, what we need in the economy is transformation. And the SMEs have been particularly hard hit. And what people don't understand is, they always question, how many of you all are there, right? There's you all aren't as much as they say, and you all are not as important. The big businesses perhaps are more important. The government gets more taxes from them, all that sort of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But let's look at the structure of Trinidad and Tobago. Let's look at rural Trinidad and Tobago. So I would categorize rural Trinidad and Tobago as every area outside of Port of Spain, Chaguanas, San Fernando, and Arima, right? Let's consider that rural Port of Spain. I mean rural Trinidad.
Mm-hmm.
When you drive through the rest of Trinidad, which a lot of people don't do, right? But let's say I myself, only having come to the Confederation of Regional Business Chambers and having to visit different chambers and stuff, started to do it myself. And what struck me was that the amount of businesses there are on high streets and minor roads, right? So even when you look at an area like San Juan, you look at the entirety of Aranguez Road business, the entirety of El Socorro Road business, the whole of the all along streets in that Barataria area business. You go into Tunapuna, you see the whole Apache Road is business.
Mm-hmm.
You look at all along the eastern main road from, I would say, as you leave Port of Spain all the way down, basically the Trin City business. You go even further, you look at Sandy Grande, it's a lot of small business. You head down Central, you head down South, even before Central, before Chaguanas, there are clusters of business. After Chaguanas, the same thing. Pinal, mm-hmm. Faizabad, Point Fortin. When you look at the quantity of small businesses, right, in a particular area, you realize that the majority of their employees come from within the area. And in a sense, you find that the small businesses within the area support the community by providing employment. Why this is important is because as an employer, I know that when people often come looking for jobs and we hire them and we say, okay, we're interested, we want to hire you. And then they come back after a while, they say, listen, you know what, this isn't working out for me. This isn't working out for me because I have to spend $50 traveling to work every day.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the week, I have no money I'm working for next to nothing. So it doesn't make sense. So they start to say, I need to find a job closer to home. And that's where the developmental aspect comes in when you talk about SMEs and why it's important as well to support SMEs.
Not only that, I mean, from the perspective as a consumer, there are some products that are provided by the SMEs at one, a cheaper price. How to put this? The products, some of the products you would find mimic the high-end products, but are still able to be utilized in that way. It may not last as long, or you may not, I don't want to use the word imitation, but if you understand what I'm saying, and there is a large sector.
I understand completely, and you're 100% correct. I would go even so
more
far
access.
You see, that's what we need more in the economy. What happened over the last 10 years is by building certain sectors of the economy, and by the gains made by certain sectors in the economy, particularly very large business, and the decline of smaller business, it shifted and completely changed the competitive environment in Trinidad. So, for example, the operating cost of a smaller business compared to the operating cost of a very large business means that the operating, obviously the operating cost of the very large business is going to be much more. The salaries and so on, upper management, marketing, advertising, mm-hmm. taxes,
utilities.
You know, all those things. You know, they may also have multiple chains that they have to service, you know, many things like that. When you look at a small business, whether it is just a family or so on, their costs are considerably different. So they are able to perhaps sell the product within their community at a cheaper price. And we have seen a lot of that in Trinidad, because for a very long time, Chaguanas was the place where it was considered that if you want to buy something and you head down to Chaguanas, you're going to get cheaper than anywhere else in Trinidad.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? And people would gravitate towards that, because you have to understand that when you reduce competition, when you reduce that competitive element in the market, then what starts to grow is monopolistic and, let's say, oligopolistic tendencies, which kind of means that you have one or very few players within a certain very, very large market segment that control the price. So basically, if these people raise the price and continue to raise the price, you have no choice but to continue to buy it. And whereas in a wider competitive environment where everybody has access to bring in that same thing, you find that there can be a substantial price difference. So the consumer tends to make their choice or has more options to them where they want to go and buy this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people blame supermarkets. Now, I'm not against any particular business, but you know, we have to understand how the business operates, right?
So are you suggesting that the government needs to look at SMEs as a complete economy on its own, and understanding how workers, the average citizen, tend to, because you mentioned it earlier, how they tend to spend their money and to have it stretch longer through the month. Are there short-term solutions that you can suggest that would encourage more attention to be paid to the SMEs and to stimulate that part of the economy?
That's a really important question, and one of the issues with that is there is no direct short-term issue that will not revolve around the supply of U.S. dollars, one. Two, when we look in particular at the Retail Pharmacy Association is part of the Confederation. When you look at what the smaller pharmacies are going through, with regard, and we see it playing off in the Joint Select Committee hearings and so on, right? The fact that they were unable to, or perhaps prejudiced against, in getting licenses and approvals and so on to bring in drugs, generic or otherwise, from different parts of the world. When you look at something like that, you realize that inherent in that is a certain danger. Inherent in that is you're looking at a country that is primarily middle and low middle income, and lower, even lower than that. A country where we haven't really even, we don't we haven't done a recent study of where the poverty line really is, right? I've read articles in the papers talking about in rural Trinidad how bad the poverty is becoming in some areas. Obviously, that didn't happen overnight. That happened over a period of time. But it could be also exactly what I've been, what you and I just discussed seconds ago, mm-hmm. which is people's access to work, the cost to get to work, which people don't talk about, right? And how that affects things. And the decline of SMEs in the rural areas in particular, who used to provide a stable source of income for these people. And when you look at the fact that the competitive environment has changed, less people are able to bring in the goods. Many retailers are stuck in a pattern where they have to, and they can only buy from very few, very large distributors who are importing on their own, and perhaps are the only ones that are able to get the licenses, approvals, and mm-hmm. so on.
Contracts and so on.
Right. Then let me ask you a question. Then who is the price setter?
Which brings in the question of not only standards and consumer, in terms of consumer rights and so on, it talks to, as you say, regulating the price. Is that a conversation that businesses are willing to enter into, price caps, etc., on certain items? You mentioned medication. Would that be a welcomed conversation?
I think before we get into price caps, why not allow market forces to work? Market forces are much more powerful and less disruptive than price caps. And in an open market, and I would say of even a fairer market, allowing market forces to work because everyone has the equal opportunity, the same as anyone else, a large company, a small company. You apply, if you fulfill the requirements, you will get through. It's as simple as that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which wasn't the case before. If that is the case, then price competition will happen naturally. Price competition will happen naturally across Trinidad and Tobago. And then that would lead to more choices for the consumers rather than just simply the government starting to get involved. Because then the more the government gets involved with price caps, the more difficult it becomes because the economy becomes less of a free economy in a sense. So if we go back to price setters and price takers, a lot of people complain about the supermarkets and say, well, the supermarkets are the one raising the prices. But silently behind the supermarkets and behind the pharmacies and behind, most retail organizations in Trinidad and Tobago would be very big distributors who are the ones who actually set the price because they are the first people, mm-hmm. right, who set the price when it lands in Trinidad and Tobago.
Mm-hmm.
Some supermarkets do import, but by and large, the majority of food that comes into Trinidad and Tobago would do so through one of our very large distribution companies. And they would be the ones who obviously have the power to set the price. If quietly prices have been raising behind the scenes, then that will be reflected in the prices that the supermarkets sell at.
Now, right. let me interject here a minute and introduce the idea of CARICOM. Now, the idea of doing regional trade, does that in any way impact on not only the goods that are received, but the prices of goods? Or is it that we don't...
Of course, because anything coming into the country immediately gets slammed with 20% duty, 12.5% VAT. Unless it is classified as not being dutiable or VATable or something. A lot of food items are. Certain medications are OTCs, some OTCs, over-the-counter meds and stuff like that are not. So it's a mixed bag, as it were. But the good thing about things imported from CARICOM or trade within CARICOM is that it doesn't always carry the tariffs and so it can be cheaper. So, for example, mm-hmm. I would say things like food and things produced within CARICOM, which is one of the reasons why our manufacturing sector has really been buoyant and doing quite well, I would say, and continuing to grow because of that CARICOM. So when it comes to food, certainly within CARICOM, but is that going to cut off food import, Billy? See, it's the same thing. When you're buying from CARICOM, what's the currency we're paying in? We're not paying in EC dollars and we're not paying in TT dollars. We're paying in US dollars. So it comes down again to whatever the whatever we hear in budgets and so on. What it comes down to is what are the actual, you know, real changes and policies that can promote growth in certain sectors and industries in Trinidad and Tobago that can genuinely help us.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at agriculture and you say, okay, you know what? Which I think the agriculture minister is doing. I mean, I've listened to one of the biggest draws that came up recently on US dollars, believe it or not, is chicken feed. So we love chicken in Trinidad and Tobago. Buy a lot of chicken. I think that's probably the number one source of protein and also the cheapest source of protein in a sense. And most plentifully used in vending and food type businesses and so on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at food, chicken feed, the importation of chicken feed, it was huge. I think that was almost $100 million or something like that. There was a lot of money going towards the importation of chicken feed. The government has said, okay, we're going to try corn. We're going to try corn projects. See if that works, then it means that we can use the corn locally in chicken farms and so on. And that could reduce the cost. There's rice, there are rice projects going on. There are different types of projects going on. But you see, one of the issues with diversification and money going into things like that, right, is access to financing. When you have very, very large companies in Trinidad and Tobago making supernormal profits.
Mr. Charon, we missed you for a little bit there. Can you repeat what you just said? Mr. Charon?
Why people are not.
Mr. Charon, we just lost you for a couple seconds there, so we didn't quite hear what you were saying.
Are you hearing me?
Yes, I'm hearing you now.
I'm hearing you.
Yeah, we just missed you for a little bit.
I'm sorry, I didn't know what happened there. But let me continue. So,
sure.
If we go back a bit to you see the it's almost as though we have two signals coming through the economy. One is we are seeing a lot of expansion, right? You can actually see it before your very eyes. You're seeing malls going up all over the place, malls being built. You're seeing supermarkets in particular expanding rapidly across Trinidad and Tobago. Almost every year, some new supermarket outlet is opening. You're looking at a place like Trin City area. They have like huge malls within walking distance of each other. More being built, right? It's a very vibrant area, but it also shows that millions of dollars are being spent and invested into the economy. On the other hand, when you look outside of certain sectors, food distribution, pharmaceutical distribution, toiletry distribution, and the retail stores that feed off of that distribution, when you look outside of that area, you don't see that. You see almost a sort of contraction. You see stagnancy, you're not seeing the growth.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are under pressure, particularly with the banks, which is another thing I will come to, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of this would have begun during the COVID policy, which was, who can operate and who can't operate, right? And if you have bodies that were operating for 2 years, earning income, and a huge section of business, almost 90% of business that were not able to operate for 2 years, obviously those people that were able to operate went through a bit of a boom period because citizens weren't completely locked down. They had to come out, they had to buy stuff, and they became the only major retail outlets for the entire of Trinidad and Tobago. So obviously there was a huge boom. And that boom and the profits, the supernormal profits made at that time would have carried them through, and that's perhaps where we're seeing that expansion coming from. But that is not reflected in 90% of the economy after that, right? Now, I would even include public servants in the boom, because public servants were one of the few groups of employees that were able to be paid throughout the entirety of the COVID pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas all the other businesses that were shut down, their employees couldn't work. So maybe that was part of it too, in terms of, you know, people having built up debts of their own, having to deal with courts, having to deal with the bank, having to deal with car loans, mortgages, and so on, which is people who don't own business had to depend on an income and weren't able to operate, and their debts also built up. So all of that, in a sense, is what this government continues to deal with, because none of those things were addressed by the previous government. But in any case, that's how the economy is. There's two sides to it. There's that side that we've seen a lot of expansion and growth. There's the other side that we're not seeing that on at all.
So let me present an option that may be controversial. It depends on where it falls. How about, if not debt consolidation, debt forgiveness? Where would that offer a solution, or would that make any financial sense?
I think, you see, this is going to be very controversial.
Well, that's why I kind of asked the question, because...
No, it is controversial.
Yes.
You know why it's controversial? Because debt forgiveness is something that it appears some people get and others cannot. The average citizen can't get that. Debt forgiveness is something that perhaps, and I'll choose my words carefully, depends on how large are your deposits in the bank. And the bank is prepared to forgive your debt compared mm-hmm. to the amount of deposits that you have in there, right? For the average citizen, there's no such thing as debt forgiveness. For the average citizen, the bank is hard.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have employees... You know, I listen to, I mean, some people in a draconian situation, man. I listen to some people who, employees and so on, who are recently and in discussions with other members of member chambers in the Confederation. And a lot of people, like home mortgage finance and so on, you have people saying, come in and accept the loan at a lower mortgage rate than the commercial banks. And then every year, that rate goes up by 0.5%. And then you miss one or two payments, and all of a sudden you're slapped with $4,000 a month for a bailiff fee. Mm-hmm. And then the arrears, and then the interest on the arrears. And then all of a sudden, you're spiraling. You're spiraling because the money that you're paying, because after you miss 2 months or 3 months, is being soaked up by the arrears and a bailiff fee. And on top of that, your mortgage rates keeps increasing. And a lot of people are trapped in that, man, and it's a terrible, terrible thing. Whereas, you know, we hear often on the political platforms and so on, and in Parliament, where very large people get away with murder. And when I say very large people, I mean people of worth, right? People who have substantial money are able to escape the same things. Do I think that... debt forgiveness is a thing? I think so, but it's a dream, right? I don't think the banks will ever go for that.
The reason why I bring it forward is that we have to be realistic in that we do understand that the economy is still reviving itself from the COVID pandemic and the following years after that. So understanding, probably because the name of the show is The Human Impact, I still think from the human aspect of understanding that if you relieve stresses, not only for the consumer, but by extension, small businesses, and then it will filter into consumption and so on. Understanding that that time period of the world's history did take a toll on economies around the world, to rejuvenate it, to press the reset button, it would in some shape, form or fashion should be implemented so that can be, you know, stimulating once again, because you would have to have...
And you know when that should have happened? That should have happened then.
Two, three years ago.
That should have happened when we were in recovery mode, because every single other country, as much as they could have afforded it, provided some kind of relief for business and for the people, whether it came in the form of some kind of stimulus grant or stimulus fund, mm-hmm. or some kind of protective fund. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
And then
mm-hmm.
the effects were horrible worldwide. Huh? When you look at a place like China that has had the most economic growth, COVID hit one of the major areas in Shanghai, which is the Bund area, restaurants and so on, really hard. The restaurant sector, services sector in Trinidad, when you come to just simple people, well, it's not simple people, but people doing simple spas and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were hit hard too. We're not even talking about retail organizations alone. But no relief in any way came, right? And it didn't come even when, you know, coming down to the end and so on, when it was said, okay, we've seen a little bit of economic growth or whatever. It didn't happen. Now, the issue about debt forgiveness is a tricky one because debt forgiveness across the board could destabilize financial institutions, particularly lending institutions, and they have to be careful about that. So I would say, you know, the idea is not to forgive debt, but allow people to access financing, even though they are in debt, for key things such as diversification, which is something at the Confederation I really believe in. And I believe that because the retail situation in Trinidad and Tobago is going to continue to be like this until we see some change in the U.S. scenario, right?
Mm-hmm.
The supply of U.S.
Mm-hmm.
It is important that small and medium businesses or people who want startups, right? People who say, well, look, I want to get into business on my own. They go into some form of light manufacturing, agricultural processing, right? Or even agriculture in terms of feeding people and so on. So we're not talking about that finished good idea of selling, you know, imported goods or selling.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about before that where we can have import substitution in the economy, where we can substitute, you know, things that are being imported into Trinidad, and where we can even try to expand enough to export within the Caribbean area and earn some U.S. dollars for ourselves. The problem with that is the financing.
Would you say we should focus more on raw materials and, let's say, the beginning of manufacturing?
I would say, well, I mean, the truth is raw materials to a large extent have to be imported.
Mm.
But what I'm talking about is the actual manufacturing, which is taking the raw materials and making something with it, making something small use with it. I mean, the largest sector of export in Trinidad and Tobago is food and beverage. Outside of food and beverage, we don't have that much. Isn't that broad or isn't that deep?
Mm-hmm.
Getting into something, for example, like garment manufacturing. Why would I say that? I say that because very recently I came back from Vietnam. I went to Vietnam kind of to look at garment factories and so on. When I went there, what I saw surprised me. Vietnam isn't as developed as, let's say, China or anything like that. They're now into that boom phase, mm-hmm. kind of thing, you could say, with manufacturing. But being very undeveloped, I went to the Mekong Delta, which is 2 hours away from Ho Chi Minh City. And the Mekong Delta basically looks like when you're driving into Central and South and you're passing all those cane fields on either side and so on. That's kind of like what it looks like, but there are towns and so on in the midst of all of that. Pretty much like it is there too. And you go down to those towns and then you find people who have little factories under their house, maybe a 1,000-square-foot factory, and they have people, you know, mainly women and some men and so on from the communities that work there. And there's a cooperative basis there where they have this company in Ho Chi Minh City who is liaising with Aloe, that big yoga brand,
mm-hmm.
that is liaising with people like Home Depot, which is liaising with people like Fashion Nova. And mm-hmm. many of these small garment factories, these cooperatives, are together creating the volume necessary to export to create the order for these very large companies and export it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go into these factories, they're so simple, you wouldn't believe, right? There's not like no super high technology.
And some of these
factories
places,
look like sheds and so on.
Yeah, right? And they provide the final product for many of the big brand names.
I was shocked.
Amazing to take a look at it. I have a call on the line and they've been waiting for a little bit. So let's hear their question. And we have about approximately 10 minutes again. I mean, this conversation is really going well and so much more to tackle. Hello, good morning. Welcome.
Hi, good morning, Tosca.
Good morning.
Yes, excellent conversation. And some of what he's saying is pure gold, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to quickly suggest two crops that I believe could have a significant impact on our foreign exchange reserves. One is soybean. He's mentioned chicken feed just now. Soybean is a prime, I think it's a base product.
Soybean is traded on the stock market feed. Internationally.
And I don't know if it consists of chicken feed as well. It could be included in that. But soybean is a significant ingredient in all animal feed, and the growing of that crop could have a significant impact on, I think we import soybean from China, so that would have an impact on our foreign exchange. So the second crop is chickpeas. Doubles is a big deal in Trinidad and Tobago, and I'm not sure how many tons of chick feed is imported, and probably from China, from India, on an annual basis, but I'm sure it's a lot, and we could put a big dent in that expenditure if we look at our in-house growing of our own breed of chickpeas. I don't know what you think about that. I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your call.
And you see what he said there. You see, one of the issues we have is access to finance. A lot of people blame the government and say the government is at fault. The government are the ones who aren't supporting the businesses 100%, but the problem is access to finance.
Mm.
What we have found is, you see, very large companies making supernormal profits, very large companies who are import-based making a lot of money. They aren't going to take the risk to diversify into something completely different. And why should they, right? If you're already making millions of dollars, if you're already making very large profits doing what you're doing, are you really going to go to the board and say, well, I think we should start to grow chickpeas. I think we should start to grow soybeans. You may be laughed at, right? They'll be like, you're crazy.
And this is the next question that I have. Is it that Trinidad and Tobago is so defined to the energy sector, oil and gas, that thinking about these very same ideas that you just brought up may sound, like you said, laughable, but they're not willing to explore those ideas that just might be the ticket to get us to another level?
The idea is not that we are not willing to explore. The idea is that to make these things concrete, the first step is financing.
Mm-hmm.
And for the private sector, the only source of financing is going to the bank. Unless the government says we're shelling out all millions and millions of dollars and giving you free grants to do these things at no interest rate, you just take the money and you go, which the government can't at this stage because they have other priorities to look at, then we have to go to the banks. And I want to make this point. A lot of the SMEs that I have spoken to, people are having a lot of problems with renewing facilities at the banks. The banks, their liabilities to the banks, the millions of dollars, they're having difficulties renewing overdraft facilities, extension to overdraft facilities. So on top of that, when you're going to the bank and saying, I want a loan to invest in soybean production, chickpea production, I want to open a garment factory, I want to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes very difficult to get the financing. It is easier to go to the bank because it's all collateral based. It's easier to go to the bank, right, and buy a $1 million car and say, I want $1 million to buy this car. And they will give you the loan to buy the car at $1 million than to go to the bank and say, I want $1 million to invest in a soybean processing facility or a soybean growing farm. You know, because the checks and balances for the bank, when it comes to the risk level, you know, the risk level that they set for these things is exceedingly high.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the biggest.
Do we need more experts to assist the financiers and bankers in developing these ideas? Or do we need like more dedicated account persons? When I say account persons who work with the banks to journey with persons who are venturing into ideas like this, like meet them step by step, let them go to the field and check out what's happening with the field, check in ever so often.
I don't mean to say it this way. You have to forgive me, but you know what? That is naive. It's exceedingly well-meaning what you're saying, but it's naive because you're dealing with institutions that aren't valuing that. Right, you're dealing with institutions that just the other day was saying, I'm going to drop $1.50 charge on every single transaction that you make in an economy like this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's madness.
Mm-hmm.
You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot of experts. There are a lot of people working behind the scenes, right? that want change and transformation in Trinidad and Tobago. I see them, I work with some of them at PSOT, within the Confederation, in some other chambers as well too, the small chambers. They have many people, economists and so on, but the bottleneck will always be financing. Now, the government has been trying to bring in alternative forms of financing. But until the banks decide what is, do the banks have a role in the rebuilding and the regrowth of our economy? Do they have a role in fostering diversification in the non-energy sector for the betterment of the economy and the betterment even of, you know, themselves in a sense, right? Because we promote growth and we promote more startups in the economy and we can build a manufacturing, we can build more people in the manufacturing sector. What is their role in that? And if they think that they're, if they see their role as the risk for us to take on to do these things, to give all these people loans for that, is too much for us when we could take all the low-hanging fruit and continue with car loans for people and carnival loans and travel loans, and we can make money off of that at less risk, then, you know, then we are really in a, we're really in a tough situation. Then it is upon the government to find some way to bring in financial institutions here that will work with, you know, will work with entrepreneurs, will work with people who are willing to take
these. Well, I was now thinking about grants and funds, because there are many organizations outside of Trinidad and Tobago that do advertise from time to time stating that they have these things that are available. They're like quotas and so on. They need to, you know, disburse this type of money because it was given by foundations, etc. Does that affect how businesses are run in Trinidad and Tobago, especially as it applies to SMEs? Let's say somebody decides, all right, the banks in Trinidad and Tobago are not really focused on developing small businesses. What does that look like if you look for international help?
Well, I mean, I think that's the stage where this government is, they're actually looking to bring people in here. We had the World Bank. We have other people coming in. I would say it's at an exploratory phase, but hopefully something will good will come out of that, and it will allow us to do exactly that, because it is, I can't see a way forward, right, if we can't jump that hurdle. And the hurdle will always be financing. Now, let me ask you a question, right? Who has the greater drive, right? Who has the greater drive, the greater desire to accept risk? A company that is already making supernormal profits, doing what they are doing and are very successful at what they're doing, or small and medium business, or people who are starting up and have a hunger to build something.
Oh, that's entrepreneurs right there. That it's small businesses.
And improve their financial situation, correct. So the change that we're looking at isn't going to come from people. Like, you know, a lot of times we hear about, like, okay, when the government sometimes projects exports and economists projects exports and so on, they're talking about people already in manufacturing sector. They're talking about existing exports. But where we want to go to is we want to build the manufacturing sector to be even larger. We want it to be even more diverse. We want the agricultural sector and the manufacturing sector to work to get to a space where we could, to some degree, 10% or 15% be able to, with, when it comes to clothing and stuff, clothe our own people, man. You understand what I mean? That we don't even have to be importing all this stuff in all the time. Or, you know, or to a certain extent, you know, feed our own people. Now, we are successful to some degree, and that's good. Like, for example, I think all our seasonings and stuff that people would use on a daily basis is things that we grow locally. I think Callaloo and stuff like that, things that we grow locally. I think there's some agricultural produce that 100% we are able to supply our nation with. And all we need to do is continue to grow that, right? So that's one aspect. But what about the other consumables, right, that people don't think about but that they need to purchase as well too? What about things like underwear? What about things like socks? What about things like basic slippers? What about things like basic clothing, T-shirts? I mean, there are some people that are manufacturing and so on. But really what we want is more people to get into to the stage where we could export the CARICOM and so on, and even find markets in the United
States.
More
international. Yeah.
Correct.
Mr. Charon, I have one more call for us to take in as we draw closer to the end of this interview, which has been, as the last caller said, you know, information abound. And I think we'll have to bring you back again to talk a little more. Good morning and welcome.
Morning to you, Tosca. Morning to your guests.
Morning.
I've been listening to your guests for the longest while. One thing I want to explain, he said he listened to the Minister of Energy and he said there's work behind the scenes. What exactly is that work that is behind the scenes that have been being said for the longest while since the Minister of Energy hits office? And the other thing about small business, you said about the loan factor compared to a vehicle to business. One of the things I always find small business should do, depending on what you want to go into, don't you think collaborating or finding what you call your capital to reduce the risk before you go to the bank, shouldn't that be a factor? And not only that, instead of you have a loan to the bank for startups, why not, you know, the point of intermediary where you almost reach the point of, depending on what you, if it's agriculture, that you can invite the bank at that point where you're almost close to really having, you know, what you call the point of having the commodity ready. What about those things instead of they taking the risk with that type of advent from scratch to finish, where if it fall apart, then they'll have to absorb the costs. I listen.
All right, Thank you so much, Eko. I am not in the Ministry of Energy, but so I can't talk about what negotiations, what are the details of negotiations behind the scenes. But what I can say is that from where we were before to where we are now, there has been significant change. From where we were before to where we are now, the current projections, the current data that is coming out from the Ministry of Trade is positive. The current projections about what is going to happen, the multinational companies that are coming in here and making deals, the deals that have been had with cross-border gas from Venezuela to Trinidad, to a certain extent, all of those seem very promising and they seem that they will happen. And we can only wait to see if it actually happens, but that means that there is work that has been going on behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. With regard to the second part of your question is, one of the biggest bottlenecks, so there's no one element, right? So you're saying that go and do your thing, and then when you start to grow your thing, the bank will then jump in. And maybe you're right, right? But the issue with that is how do you, when you're actually in crafting a startup, right? So let's say you have a retail business. You say, okay, you know what? I'm going to take the risk and I'm going to diversify. I know exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to bring down some machine and I'm going to make this thing. And you'll be very surprised to know that the machine is the least cost of all the other things, all the other factors of production that you might need, right? Because in China, there's so much competition, there's so many machines, you're bound to get something nice and small that you could bring in and you could set up yourself, and it wouldn't even cost you close to $50,000 to do so. So you have that worked out, right? So you have your machine. You now need a place to set up your machine. And you can't set up your machine under your house. And so you have to go to the market. You have to go to the real estate market. I have been dealing with the real estate market in Trinidad. There are many warehouses across Trinidad and Tobago that have been unrented for 2 to 3 years. They have been unrented because they're asking prices $30,000 to $50,000 a month plus VAT, right? And on top of that, now they don't have the electrical
capacity
requirements, right? So when you talk to them and you say, listen, I'm bringing in a machine, I need 330 volts. We don't have that, sir. Would you consider putting in a kiosk? No, we don't want to put in a kiosk because if you leave, then we could get stuck with a $10,000 extra bill a month for the kiosk. Do you have even 220 volts? No, sir, we don't have 220 volts. We have 110. So the price of real estate in Trinidad and Tobago and the actual infrastructure, right, means that you either have to pay top dollar for a startup to actually find the warehouse that you need to begin the cost, right, which is $30,000 to $50,000 a month. Well, even more than that, just to get in the door, right? Because you obviously you had to pay a month in advance and deposit and whatever else.
And if it is you happen to have a worker, then the materials,
correct.
Yeah.
So, and then after that, now, you say, well, okay, you know what? I'm going to build. But this real estate bubble in Trinidad and Tobago is a really, really difficult thing. I mean, on one side, business is facing the realities of this real estate bubble in Trinidad. And then the normal person who is aspiring to have a home and own a home, they're facing it too. Because the cost of you know, even a two-bedroom somewhere, or the cost of building, or the cost of just purchasing land is, you know, is quite exorbitant, which is why so many people find themselves in debt when they go and take mortgages and so on. But for young people coming out of university, and even if they get decent jobs and so on, it's tough, right? Because the real estate market is expensive, and that affects us. So when you're going to finance, even before you reach the stage of being able to produce a thing, something as simple as a land, which is an important factor of production, where setting up my factory. Do I have all the inputs that I need, plumbing, mechanical, electrical, or whatever, to be able to run this thing the way it's supposed to be run? That is quite costly, and that's why you end up going to the bank, because most of the times, you kind of have that already, right? I mean, I don't know. I know very few people, right, who were not one of the people that were able to operate during COVID that are not in debt at this point in time. And so the ability to diversify, I don't think there's anywhere around being able to say, I need to go and get the additional financing. Because at some point, even if you say, well, okay, you know what, I'm putting that machine underneath my house. I'm going to put the machine underneath my house and disturb my neighbors and things. But you know what? I don't care. I'm going to operate the machine underneath my house. You're still going to need additional money just to get the things up and going. Bring in your raw material, right? Maybe you need to purchase a van. Maybe you need to purchase some kind of a vehicle to be able to distribute your product and so on. Your place is obviously going to grow. I don't think, you know, so it's, I understand what you're saying. I think what you're saying is basically, you know what, go ahead and start your thing. And then when you reach a certain level, the bank will take you. Yes, you know why the bank will take you? Because you take all the risk up front and you pop all the money up front. And when you now start to make profit, the bank say, great, I will come in and I go own your factory, because you will take out a mortgage on it.
It basically feels like Shark Tank, you know, when you present your business and then they want, even before really getting into the nitty-gritty of it. Mr. Charon, I have to stop here. I mean, we can go on and on and on. And I think we will, you know, request your time again inside the Human Impact to really get into the nitty-gritty for small businesses as it pertains to this economy and eventually what the sector can provide, not only to the average citizen, but the middle class, and keeping the middle class going, because that is another conversation in itself altogether. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
All right.
You're tuned into the all-new Freedom 106.5. 106.5.